Welcome to the Conk. This is true storytelling, 5 minute stories on a 5 minute true stories on a topic. We do this every month. This is the third one. So thanks for coming out. We'd like to thank Satchels and LSE for hosting us here. And I'm Natalie. I'll be your MC for the evening. Welcome. So this evening's topic is In the Blink of an Eye. So get your stories rolling, get some confidence, and give it your all. This is a safe space. We will not laugh at your story. Feel encouraged. I know that that Bill has a story to kick us off. So we'll go ahead and get started. Sorry.
You're fired.
Can't put me on the spot like that. I'll start it off by saying we usually have a hat that you sign up on a piece of sheet of paper and drop your name in the hat, and we'll pick your hat to pick your names out of the hat to tell stories. We don't have that tonight because I lost my bag of conch goodies. So if you want to tell a story tonight, just approach Natalie, beg, plead, and pay her money, and she might let you up here and tell a story. So the theme tonight is In the Blink of an Eye. And when I really started thinking about this theme, I was trying hard to think of a story to tell you, and it made me realize in my life, my 46 years, I've had probably an improbable amount of close calls that I have managed to walk away from relatively unscathed. Most of them occurring in the blink of an eye in an instant. And when I started thinking about that, I realized I go back and forth between fluctuating between thinking, when is this going to end? When's my luck going to run out? And when is it all going to just kind of come crashing in on me? But the majority of the time, I choose to believe that this is just the natural way of things and have faith in things working out all right. And for the most part, they have. So I don't think it's relative to anything to do with good planning or good intention. I just think it's general dumb luck. But hopefully it won't run out. And we know when things happen so instantaneously, like they do in a blink of an eye, that things can go any different direction, and in sometimes unalterable direction. But it doesn't necessarily have to be tragic. And I don't know if it speaks to my morbid sense of looking at the world that it generally brings up things tragic, but I wanted to emphasize that point that it doesn't necessarily have to be tragic. And thanks to Jordan from the other month telling a story about football, because it reminded me of a football story that I can tell you that is especially appropriate in this town, I think, and the timing of the season. So it goes back to when I was 12 years old and growing up in Indianapolis, Indiana. And I went to a tiny elementary school where we had maybe 20 kids in each class. And in elementary school there, we end in sixth grade and move to junior high, which is seventh, eighth, and ninth grade. And the prospect of moving to junior high meant going from a tiny school to a very large school where I would have hundreds of classmates. And being a fairly nervous and awkward kid, this didn't sit too well with me. I was very anxious and uncomfortable with the idea of going to this junior high. And walking in that way, things didn't start off too well, but most of my friends were kind of moving on, making their adjustments, making new friends, and things were a little slow to start for me. So I was eager to kind of get things ramped up and make friends and start moving on with things, but it just wasn't happening. And I had one friend, Tom, who one day after school, invited me to come play football with him and his friends. They used to play after school at a church lot, and they played tackle football with no pads. And that didn't make much of an impression on me when I was hearing it, but football really wasn't a sport I'd played a whole lot. I never played organized football, and I'd watched a lot of football, but played some flag football. And so I get out to this field with these guys who I didn't know very well. I knew some of them by name, but couldn't really count any of them as my friends. And I am participating, but not really getting plugged into the game. On offense, nobody really knew me, so the plays weren't coming my way. And on defense, it just hadn't happened. But at one point in the game, I'd love to say it was a crucial end zone kind of battle, but it was just a regular play in the game. But it was monumental for me. I was on defense, and this play actually did come to me. There was a fellow who I knew named John, who was the running back, who had gotten the ball handed to him. And he was a pretty stout kid, and I was a pretty scrawny little 12-year-old. And he took off like a rocket straight at me. And this all happened instantaneously, but I don't know how I thought through this quickly, but I knew I had a choice. I could stand there and stand my ground, or I could get out of the way and let this guy score a touchdown. Well, circumstances being what they were, I wasn't about to let this guy score a touchdown, because these people who knew me would forever know me as somebody who would do something like that. And that wasn't really how I wanted to be known at this school. There was a lot of tension in the school, making things worse for me, issues of things like drugs and alcohol and racism and violence, and even to the point of having sheriffs stationed in the hallways, which was pretty dramatic for suburban Indianapolis. Anyway, so this school was someplace I really wanted to fit in. And so this guy John is coming trucking at me what seemed like 100 miles an hour, and I decided to stand my ground. So I planted my feet and closed my eyes and dropped my shoulder. And I don't really know what happened, but I think it was the proverbial brick wall incident where this guy hit me. And the next thing I knew, I was on the ground, he was on the ground. Then I was standing, and all I could see were stars. And then when the stars cleared, I noticed he was still on the ground, and everybody standing around me had their mouths open, and they couldn't believe what they'd just seen. And poor John got up and didn't really know what hit him. And the next day in school, all these boys were talking about was how tough I was and how I knocked the crap out of this guy who was hobbling around the school with a deep thigh bruise. And so it made me realize in that instant on the football field, I had, for the first time, gained a sense of identity with these people and a sense of respect that I'd never had with them before. And it gave me a little bit of a sense of place in this new world I was walking into, junior high. Thank you.
I apologize. I did not mean to put you on the spot like that. But I knew it had to be a good one, so I knew it'd be a great way to start off. Anyone else have a story? Don't be shy. I have a short story. I've been thinking about this all week, actually, and the only thing that I could come up with is recently I took a trip to China, and after I got back, I think it was the first or second week after I got back, we were driving on the interstate, and out of nowhere, it looked kind of stormy, but it hadn't started to rain yet, it wasn't really thundering, but all of a sudden, lightning struck the median, probably 50 feet in front of where we were driving, and that obviously happened in the blink of an eye. And then a week later, I saw lightning strike a tree in my backyard, again, probably 50 feet from where I was, so... no one needs to be 50 feet from me. That's not a safe place to be. So that's Thank you. Thank you. Welcome.
Hi. Thank
oh.
you.
Hi.
Thank you. Hi. I have a nice harmless one, so I figured it would get you guys moving a little bit. And I hate holding microphones, so tell me if this gets odd or if I'm making you all uncomfortable. Yeah, I hate it. I just got to do it that way. In the blink of an eye, and also the fact that today is September 11th, brings us to the point that it's September 11th. I was in New York on September 11th, and this is not an American story. This is not my story. This is the story of a Frenchman, my friend Alban, who flew into New York because he loved America. He loved rock and roll. He was like this, like, very soft-spoken. He was sort of bendy. He sort of bends. And he says, I want to see art studios and to see Lou Reed, and I just want to see New York. And so he arrived on September 10th at about 8:45 p.m. And after getting through JFK, which takes you about 6 hours, we wound up in Manhattan at a Puerto Rican restaurant, and we had some rice and beans, and I can't remember if he's vegetarian. He probably had some oxtail. And then a accordion band. They even have accordions in Puerto Rico, I don't know, but then this accordion band came, and we were like, this is great. Alban is getting the best New York experience ever. He is getting this American experience, and he came over because he was a comic book publisher, and he had boxes and boxes and boxes of French comics that he wanted to sell to Americans who would have really gobbled this stuff up. And so we just thought this was the greatest beginning to his week, 2 weeks, I don't know, in America. And so we took him home, we put him on our couch, and we said, Alban, we are going to get up tomorrow. We're going to go to our jobs. We had this is me and my wife, Lila, who some of you may know, and we had graphic design jobs. We traditionally would like go in our pajamas, and it would be like 11 a.m., and we'd sort of stroll into the office. But because Alban was on the couch, we sort of got up kind of early. We whispered around him, and we sort of tiptoed around him, and we went out around 8-something and had coffee together, and then got on the train. We were in Brooklyn, and the first stop into Brooklyn, and we tiptoed around him. On the way to the subway, we noticed the smoke. It was like, oh. And then people on the street saying, oh, I think somebody flew a Cessna into the Twin Towers. We're like, oh, weird. We get on the subway, and we go under the Brooklyn River, the East River. What's that called? The East River. And then we come up, or at least I did. Lila was on a different stop. And now two buildings have holes in them. And we're like, oh, two Cessnas. How weird. Anyway, by the time I get to my job, all sorts of shit is happening, and people are running around like crazy, and everybody is watching the television, and Lila and I finally realize that something is up, and everybody realizes something is up. For some reason, our cell phones, which we had just gotten like 2 months ago, are working, and no one else's are. So Lila and I actually connect 40 blocks away pretty easily, and all the subways are closed, right, for most of September 11th. We're trying to get back to Brooklyn. So what happens is everyone who lives in Brooklyn walks across the 49th Street Bridge, this giant exodus back to Brooklyn. And then during that exodus, we realize, oh, my God, how is Alban? How the hell do you call a French cell phone in New York City when you're in New York City? We got to find out if he's okay. And we can't fit, we try calling him, we don't know what's going on, oh my God, where was he, what's going on? And we make our way slowly, we just sort of walk our way to home. We still no sign of Alban. We call him, we finally reach him, and he says, New Yorkers are crazy. Everyone they've got their cars open and they're listening to the radio, and like everybody's just sort of like standing around listening to the radio. It's so crazy. He had just gotten on the first subway into Manhattan now that the subways were running after like 5 p.m. or something. And we're like, Alban, do you know what happened? And he says, oh, yes, my girlfriend was calling and she said, am I okay? And she told me, and I don't know. It was this big mess up. But we said, Alban, get to Brooklyn, come to the bar, and sit still and cry with us. And that's basically all we did with Albon. He wanted to see Lou Reed. He wanted to sell a million copies of comic books. All we did for the next 2 weeks that he was with us is stare. We went to Moe's Bar. No, it wasn't Moe's. Lucinda's? I forget what it's called. And we just stared and stared and stared. And I've barely heard from Albon since. And I think we ruined him. Like, he had this whole desire to see America. And he, I mean, he actually, I think, was pretty interested. He was compelled by the fact that he was there. And I think it's part of a story that he took in pretty deeply. But I also think he's gotten a lot depressed. I haven't heard from him on Facebook. Every once in a while, I see him pop up, and it's like, oh, I'm not going out much. I don't know if we wrecked him or not. There's not much of a moral to this story. It's mostly about the sad timing that this cute friend of ours had. If you ever see him on Facebook, tell him to get in touch with me, because he doesn't respond to my emails. Thanks.
All right, if you're just joining us, this is a reminder that this is The Conk. It is true storytelling by you, an audience member. Stories of 5 minutes or less, excuse me. We'd like to thank Satchels and LSC again for having us out. And I have a friend, Leanna, who will be telling our next story. She knew this time, I'm not putting her on the spot.
Hi, everybody. I have a fun blink of an eye story. I always wonder, because it's like, you know, I don't know. I don't know if anyone else, if you don't know these people, would find this interesting. I hope so. So this is going to be about my brother's 16th birthday party. My siblings and I are really close, and my sister and I decided to throw our little brother a wonderful, amazing 16th birthday party that he did not deserve. But it was mostly for our own benefit. You know, we were all getting older, and so we had to do something really fun, you know, just on that cusp of too old to actually plan a real live treasure hunt on an abandoned distant island and think it was cool. So, you know, we went out ahead of time, you know, took the boat out to this island, Key Waden Island, if any of y'all are familiar with that, down off Marco. And we buried a box, made a really cool old treasure chest, and we filled it full of amazing things, you know. It didn't have very much money, but I think it had, like, food and candy and probably a few little bottles of liquor, maybe. And so we buried that. We made a really cool map. We did all that stuff. And, you know, we get back, we dressed up, you know, I made, like, pirate winch bodices out of placemats and all that shit stuff. And then, so we get the brother and his friends all together, and we're all excited, and, you know, there's no adults, it's just us. The oldest person was my sister, who was 18 at the time, and we took out my grandfather's boat, and I think there were 10 of us all together. And so we go out to this island. For whatever reason, the brother's girlfriend gets hungry. She was really needy. And so they drop us off at the island and decide they're going to go off and get food at Marco Island. They've got little carts and things like that. And so they were going to be gone for literally 10 minutes, and they were gone for 2 hours. And by the time they get back, it was getting dark. You wouldn't be able to read or follow the treasure map directions. You know, we were getting really angry, because all of this hard work was gonna be for nothing. And finally they show up. They have dramatic stories like they always do about, you know, getting stuck on a sandbar, and then they finally got out, but they had to help this other person out. But they finally made it back. My uncle and his wife and their 4 kids, who were, the oldest one was probably 8 at the time, they also came out on a separate boat. And it was getting dark, and so the treasure hunt was really very uneventful. You know, I think we ended up just, like, telling them where it was, because the teenage boys had no interest in this amazing event we had planned and worked so hard for. They just wanted to hang out with the girls on the beach. So, you know, whatever, they find the thing, we're going home. Sarah and I are disappointed, because once again, Jeff lets us down. And we get back on the boat, and we're all tired. It's pitch black at this time, and it's about a 40-minute boat ride back to the dock. So we're cruising along about 25 minutes into the trip. You know, our uncle comes up alongside us, and you know, we're planing and we're cruising, we're going fast, not too close, but you know, we could see the lights on their boat, and the lights on the boat start flashing for about 5 seconds, and I think I may have been the only one to notice them, but I was like, what, you know, in that 5 seconds that I saw the lights flashing, what could they possibly want? Are they being funny? Do they want to race? It's not really appropriate to be doing this in the water. But so at that moment, I figured out maybe there's something wrong. I heard my brother's friend scream, "Rocks!" And nobody had realized it was so dark. We were so close inland. We hit the rocks coming out of the jetty in a pass. And the boat went flying in slow motion. I turned around and saw my brother like cartwheeling out of the boat. It was like very, very dramatic. And it was amazing how many things I saw in slow motion at one time in this 1 second, this blink of an eye. Hey, that's the name of the thing. And fortunately, the girlfriend, who I never thought was the sharpest tool on the tree, had the good sense to pull out the emergency key clip thing, whatever, that shuts off the engine. She actually, now I just found out, is getting her PhD in Harvard, which is great for her. She's a lot smarter than I thought she was. But so after this happened, the hull, the fiberglass of the boat was completely shredded. You know, this boat had been completely outfitted with a brand new engine, and everything was new, and it was like its maiden voyage. And we're taking it back, crashed with a bunch of probably drunk teenagers to my grandparents' house. And we get back, and they had planned this big surprise fish cookout dinner with family. And we get there, and we're just like all crying and hysterical. Nobody died, and that's important. We thought they were going, because there were rocks like coming out of the water everywhere. And we thought Jeff was a goner for sure, but one of the friends jumped in to save him. But anyway, it was a very traumatic event. And I'm happy to say that about 10 days ago, that boat, this has been 7 years since the event, the boat has now finally been fixed. Yes, the propeller is this part. Oh, I've got more. This part apparently that needed to be replaced was at the was in Japan when the tsunami hit, and there was some meltdown, one of those events, and so the plant melted down, and so those parts for the boat just became available again. So that's why it took 7 years. The first few years of with just sitting there didn't really matter. I'm still bitter about that event night. Thank you.
Thanks, Leanna. This is Mr. Condra.
Yeah.
Welcome.
The notorious Mr. Condra. I want to tell a story about when I was hit by a drunk driver. I work in the field of substance abuse treatment. I've been doing this for a couple of decades. And so I've worked with a lot of DUI type situations. Anybody in here gotten a DUI recently, you think? Okay, well, you don't have to say. Okay. Only one? Yeah. So my daughter, when she was like 16, I bought her this car for $500. And it was like a 1987 boxy Aries. Remember those? They actually had chrome bumpers on them still. And so this car was literally owned by a little old lady who had bought it new. And the interior and the exterior was, you know, immaculate. Everything under the hood, though, was pretty well shot. And, of course, she only had it a few weeks and it broke down on her. But she loved this car. She was so proud of it. And so it was being her first car. So I took it to a place on South Main at the time, got it fixed, but it had been several days. It had been sitting there. I had not had time to get her. At that time, we lived out in the west side of the Latchwell County, Newberry area. And so what I did is I told her, she was like whining and complaining about it's like Saturday night and she can't go anywhere because her dad hasn't gotten her car back to her yet. And so I said, okay, listen, it was on a night that the Gators were having a homecoming. I think they were playing Tennessee. It was like a late game. And so what I told her was, the game's about to get over with. If we go down Newberry Road, it's going to be an absolute mess with all the cars getting out. So let's do this. Let's go up Williston Road, go up Waldo Road, go up South Main. The car was just sitting in an open lot. I'd already paid for the repair and everything. I just needed to pick it up. So you come with me, and we'll get the car, and we'll get out of town before they get that Gator game gets out, and we won't get caught in traffic. So we rushed into town, went over to Williston Road, up Waldo, went to South Main, went to the place, and I told her I would drive it back since just to see how the work went on it. And so at that time I had a little Toyota Corolla. And this is when the Toyota Corollas were really small, okay? And so the mechanic who had repaired the car apparently was a really tall fellow because he had jacked that seat all the way back. It was one of those seats that is a complete, it's like one seat. It's not like separate seats. And so can I take this off? Okay, so I'm sitting there, and I'm trying to get the seat to come up so it can be a comfortable length with me at the, steering wheel, and I can't get the thing to move up. It's just like jammed. So what's going to happen is that I start driving the car like this, and then just right before we started, my daughter said to me, "Oh, Dad, I think the seatbelt doesn't work either." I said, "Why didn't you tell me this? I would have gotten them to replace it or fix it or whatever." And so, sure enough, it had like no, tension to it whatsoever. I went ahead and put it on. I said, "Let's get out of Dodge. Let's get out of here before the game. The game is now letting out." So I'm going the speed limit down South Main, take a right on Waldo Road. I'm going right through the intersection at Southwest 13th and Williston Road there. And the light is green. The light is green, folks. It's like, oh, great, we've made it. We're going to miss all this traffic and everything. But right when I was going through the intersection, doing the speed limit, I saw this blur of this car in front of me. Where it came from, I didn't know. And here's the odd thing, folks. You see in movies about the slowdown. Has everyone seen that thing where, the guy's reaching for something and it's literally just a microsecond or nanosecond. But when this guy was about to hit me head on, it was just like in the movies. It was like there was nothing you can do, and like everything slows down, even though it's like microseconds, So he runs right into the front of me. The G-force was something I've never experienced. I went all the way forward. The seatbelt held. Had that seatbelt not held, I wouldn't be here tonight, definitely. But the entire front got caved in. My daughter was in my car behind me. She saw it all happen. So she's screaming bloody murder. I could hear her from inside my car. The car is so crushed in that I couldn't get out of my side. I had to climb out of the driver's seat on the passenger side, front passenger seat, and get out. And she's screaming and hollering, and I said, I'm okay. I walked over to the car that hit me. It was a little Passant. Folks, those Passants have great crumple zones in them. This thing looked like an accordion. I mean, it was like an accordion, like something you see in a movie. And the windows were tinted, and I went around to the driver's side. It had gotten twisted around. After it hit me, it kind of turned somehow. So I went over to the driver's side, and I could see a somebody's inside there, but I can't make out really what's going on. So I open up the door, and there's this young man sitting there, 21, 22 years old, looking very preppy, college student, I assume, and it turned out to be, yes, it was, true. And I looked down at him, his airbag had gone off, and I asked him, I said, "Are you okay?" And he looked up at me and said, "Dude, I don't want to drive this car anymore." And I said, "Don't worry, you're not driving this car anymore. You're in debt, definitely." So at the time, even though I've worked in substance abuse, dealt with a lot of DUI offenders over the years, it never entered my mind that this guy was under the influence. I was stunned. My daughter was stunned. My daughter started yelling and cursing and using words towards him for destroying her car that I didn't know a 16-year-old would know. And police showed up. The police officer had to tell my daughter, "Lady, you need to go over there in the parking lot and leave us alone." But sure enough, the guy got out of the car and he was just totally chilled. He was just like, "No big deal. Got two totally demolished cars here, almost died." And he's just like, chilled, you know, just got cool. And when the police showed up, I did say, "I think he's under the influence of something, officer." I didn't smell any alcohol. So sure enough, a few moments later, they did the field sobriety test on him and all that. He would not do the breath test, but he did agree to do some of the field sobriety tests. So of course, he miserably failed it. He couldn't keep one foot up off the ground. He was under the influence of something, obviously. But a few minutes later, though, after the car, the police were there. Apparently, a lot of his friends saw the car. They started showing up. And then this one young lady pulled up, got out of the car. She walked over and saw this crumpled passant. She put her hands on her ears, and she started, like, wailing, like, "Ah, ah, ah, ah." And, of course, what it turned out to be was this was his girlfriend, and it wasn't his car, it was her car. Then about 10 minutes later after that, this other car, big old Lincoln Continental, pulled up, really nice-looking, brand-new Lincoln Continental for that time. This was, like, 2000, okay? And middle-aged woman got out, dressed very nicely, and she got out. And by this time, you got a whole audience of people. Traffic is not moving, by the way. Traffic's not going anywhere down Southwest 13th. And she starts screaming at this young lady, his girlfriend, "Why don't you go get another alcoholic boyfriend?" So apparently there was some history here that we were seeing. I feel kind of sorry for the young man. I knew what was going to happen. I knew he was going to wind up going to jail tonight. Because at the time, I actually worked with Alachua County Court Services, and one of my jobs was to go into the jail and screen people for the Alachua County Work Release Program. So guess who I would screen if he had applied? This young man. So anyway, I knew he was going to get, I knew he was under the influence because he failed the field sobriety test. And I had access the next morning, of course. I went in to work and I checked. And sure enough, they charged him with DUI. I thought so. But here's the thing. He was only like 21, 22 years old. This was his third DUI. He had completely lost his license already by that time for 5 years. He was driving on a suspended license, and he went out and got another DUI. And of course, what turned out later on was it wasn't alcohol that was under the influence. He was doing ecstasy, some pills, benzos, stuff like that. So anyway, blink of an eye, my life could have dramatically changed had it not been for a seatbelt that was pretty crummy but still worked. Okay.
Thanks, Mr. Condra.
Hello. My name is Laura, and I have a blink of the eye story. My story takes place at Buholtz High School back in, I think, around 1998. Can y'all hear me okay? Okay. The story takes place in about 1998, and I was teaching at Buholtz High School at the time. I was teaching special ed, and my class was called Varying Exceptionalities, And that means people have different, you know, disabilities, like learning disabilities or educably mentally handicapped, behavior disorders, that sort of thing. So it was only about my third year teaching. I had this one class, it was my sixth period class, and they were my worst class by far. In the beginning of the year, there was probably about 25 students in there, and I probably wrote like, you know, 5 referrals a day or something like that. Like I said, it was only my third year teaching, not very experienced. It was a crazy class, and everybody is totally working at different levels. Some people don't know how to multiply. Some people are working on percents. Some people are working on consumer math. So everybody's just like totally all over the place. So by the end of the year, actually, or towards the end of the year, the class actually dwindled down to probably about 10. So it was a nice good level. Everybody was working, you know, everybody's working on their different things, and I would just kind of go around and help people with whatever subject they were working on, multiplication, percents, whatever. So one day, my class is all sitting, everybody's working on their different things, I'm walking around to help the different students, and in the back of the classroom, all of a sudden, I heard a screech, like, ah! And my first thought was, okay, there's either a roach or a mouse, and it was Sandy, this girl Sandy, because her and Corey were sitting there working. So I thought, okay, because we actually did see a mouse once in the back of the classroom. It was pretty dirty. But so I turned around, and I expected it to be Sandy and this little mouse or a roach. Well, I turned around, and it wasn't Sandy, but it was Corey. And Corey was a very flamboyant young man. And he was standing there screeching at the top of his lungs, and he was holding his hand over his face, over his eye, and screaming and like just totally shaking, my eye, Miss Laura, my eye. And I look over and I go over there, and his eyeball is, I kid you not, hanging out of the sockets. Seriously, like you can see it hanging down on the threads and the eyeball just hanging out there. It's true, yeah. And he had these really huge bug eyes. You know, he was always scratching his eyes and he had these really huge bug eyes. So imagine just like looking and seeing this eyeball hanging down. And of course it's, you know, I'm like, oh my God, what do I do? I would totally freaked out. Everybody in the class, you know, they were usually pretty talkative. Dead silence. Nobody said a word. And I look over and I'm like, oh my God, what do I do? You know, number one rule of teaching is never leave your classroom unattended, right? So I had a volunteer who was working in this little closet room with a student. So I went to her and I was like, can you please take Corey to the clinic? And she said, yeah. So they like, you know, hurried to the clinic and he was gone. The rest of us, we just like sat there in total silence. Nobody, I mean, like I said, they were usually super talkative. Nobody said a word. We just all sat there. We're like, oh my God, that did not really happen. Did that really happen? And like the teacher next door came in, she was like, what happened? I'm like, well, I'll tell you later. I can't really talk about it right now. That didn't really happen. But so anyways, later on, about an hour later, Corey came back to the classroom and he is sitting there with an ice pack, of course, over his eye. Because at the schools in Gainesville, all they have at the clinic is pretty much Band-Aids and a bag of ice as an ice pack. So he's sitting there with the bag of ice over his eye. And I was like, oh my God, Corey, what happened? And, you know, he actually, he told me, he was like, well, Miss Brittany, I was totally scratching my eye with the pen. And apparently it was the cap side of the pen, and the cap totally got stuck on his eyelid, and he just went to move it out of his face, and that's when his eyelids flipped over and his eyeball came out. Yes. Yeah. His eye was completely blood red. It looked horrible. And I asked him, I was like, is your mom coming to get you, you know? Unfortunately, he lived in, like, Kennedy Homes. His mom couldn't, this is Buchholz. His mom had no way to come get him. So the poor child had just sit there with his bag of ice on his eye, totally miserable. So it was crazy. And I saw him actually, you know, like, you know, even after, you know, teaching there, and a few of the other students in the class, I've seen them over the years. And every time we see each other, we were like, oh my God, do you remember the eyeball? Nobody believes it. Like, nobody ever believes it. They're like, no way, that couldn't happen. But if you knew Corey, you would believe it. And so the moral of the story is never scratch your eye with a pen.
That definitely made me squirm. Oh man, I didn't even see it. All right. What's your name? Eric.
Okay. Hello, my name's Eric. So I kind of have one jotted down. I think I kind of outline. But okay. So when I was age around 8 to 9, I lived in Sioux City, Iowa. And I had grandparents who lived in Wisconsin. So, of course, nice summer day, we go out and we travel to Wisconsin. My grandpa has a pond, a lot of places. I like chasing frogs and stuff like that, too. So it was a real great little wildlife slice of Americana thing. So we get in the car and we go on, like, it's like a 10-hour drive. So we start going across the state of Iowa, and then we get into Wisconsin, and suddenly the storms start clouding over, clouds, and then severe, like, rain just starts pouring all over, you know. Turn on the radio, of course, they're announcing severe thunderstorms, and I love how they always announce that by counties, so you don't know where any of the severe stuff is. There's people parked on the side of the road underneath, like, overpasses trying to wait out the storm. So, but my dad, he's a red truck driver. So like postal service, rain, you know, shine, he did that and then some, you know, but like storms, people got to get their bread, you know? So, we keep driving and he's, you know, hell bent on getting through the storm. And, suddenly, clockwise, 1, 2, 3, the car just spins, middle of the highway, and then we just stop. And then slam, 1, 2, 3, counterclockwise, the other way, and then we're back going straight in the road. So we don't know what happened. We just keep driving on, and then we just sort of finish, and we stop in like a parking lot, like I think like a Walmart parking lot somewhere, and we kind of take the time to kind of conduct ourselves. And we're all kind of sitting. My mom had us situated with pillows, just because the storm was so severe and stuff. And I just recall just head down in the pillow, screaming, as the whole thing happens. And then so as we get off at the parking lot, you know, and then we suddenly realize that what could have caused it, but rather a tornado, had hit us, possibly, and. So we finished off the drive and got to Wisconsin safely. No damage was done to the car at all. It was just a bit of bruised egos and but so careful of driving in stormy weather. So thank you.
Thanks, Eric.
Okay, so 6 years ago, and you can help me with the chronology if necessary, but 6 years ago, I was working at a office in Chicago that sold audiovisual equipment for and home entertainment centers. And I'd been doing this job for about 9 months when I began having a total identity crisis and realized this was so not at all the person I was. And I was a office manager, which was basically a glorified receptionist or a go-to person, and I did a lot of filing and answering the phone. So I decided not only to quit my job, but also that I needed to do something really radical to reclaim my identity as an adventurous free spirit. So I decided that I would take a trip with my 9-year-old. And I was pretty sure from the beginning that this wasn't going to be like a I wasn't going to take an airplane. I wasn't going to take the Amtrak. And then I ruled out driving a car, too. which left the options of horseback and train hopping and hitchhiking and riding a motorcycle. That was my list. Well, I have a lot of friends who hop trains, and after a few, maybe two conversations with a couple of them, they really quickly convinced me that that was a pretty horrible idea, and that best case scenario, I got arrested and have my child taken away. So that one came off the list. And then the horseback wasn't very practical because I don't ride horses and we didn't know how to get horses. So that one came off the list. And then hitchhiking just seemed like kind of a big ordeal to do with a 9-year-old across the country. So that one came off the list, which left, by process of elimination, motorcycle. But I'd never ridden a motorcycle before, and I didn't own a motorcycle. So I went about the work of finding a motorcycle. And then about a week before we were going to leave for our trip, and my friend here was staying with us at the time, I took a 2-day learn to ride a motorcycle class. And got my certificate. I actually didn't ever get my license. I went to the DMV to get my license, but it was raining that day, and you can't take the test if it's raining. So, and that was the day before we were going to leave. So anyway, you know, I'd taken the class. I knew what I was doing. We had our bike all packed up. We were good. So my 9-year-old was really excited about this. He got in the back of the bike, and we took off. Not quite into the sunset, but it was probably afternoon by the time we got on the road. We had, you know, 2 saddlebags and our sleeping bags and our tent and a monkey, which was our mascot. And we headed south through Indiana and then south some more through Kentucky and then Tennessee and then went to the Mammoth Caves. That was in Kentucky, actually. And then we went down to Atlanta, and then we were in Asheville hanging out with friends, and we have a lot of friends in Asheville, and you know, we had a really nice place to stay, and we were just having such a blast in Asheville. So I was really reluctant to leave, but I figured we would camp at Mount Mitchell that night, which is really close to Asheville, right? It's like, what, 30 minutes away or something. So, you know, I was in no rush, you know? It was like, we'll go to the co-op one last time, we'll go visit our friends again, so... You know, we'll get to Mount Mitchell, it'll be sunset, it'll be perfect, you know. So we left Asheville probably around 6 o'clock. Got on the Blue Ridge Parkway, it was all really beautiful. The last of the rhododendrons were blooming, the sun was really great in the sky. And we got up to Mount Mitchell, and it was like, if any of you have been to Mount Mitchell, it's like the highest peak east of the Mississippi, and you're just on top of the world in the clouds, and there's just rolling mountains and all like 360 degrees. It's really quite spectacular. And there was yarrow blooming everywhere. It was a golden moment until we got to the ranger station and to, you know, book our campsite. And he informed me that those campsites have been all booked up for about 3 months now. It was a Friday night. So, you know, it's cool, you know, we're gonna figure this out, you know, roll with it. So I stayed calm, and we thought, I considered briefly, like, maybe we'll just go and ask somebody else if we can stay at their campsite, you know. We're cute mom and a kid on a motorcycle, you know, with a monkey mascot, you know, they would love to have us. But he also said, well, there's also a place, you know, real close to here, it's just like, you know, 15-minute drive, just down the road. And there's plenty of campsites there, it's a national park. So I said, that's probably the more sensible option, so we'll head out. By this time, even though it was like a really nice summer day, we're really high, we're at highest peak east of the Mississippi, so it's actually getting really cold. And then as we like head down the mountain, you know, the beautiful sunset just happened on top of the mountain, so now it's like getting really cold. And we're heading down, and it turns out to be quite, you know, maybe 20, 15 minutes in a car, but it took us a long time. And then we found the road, and it's a dirt road, and by now it's like really getting dark. And so we're going down this little dirt road, you know, finally find where the campsites start. And we look on the left, and there's a campfire. And we drive a little more. And this is just one of those, like, you know, DIY. You know, you don't check in with anybody. You just go find your site. So look on the right, there's a campfire. On the left, there's a campfire. There's a bunch of horses in the campground that night. On the right, campfire, another campfire. There's another campfire. And there's maybe like, you know, going past maybe 18 sites. And we start going up this hill, and there's no more campfires, no more sites. And then I see off to the right something that looks like maybe it's a campsite, so I pull in there, all right, like park the bike, and I'm, you know, being really cheerful still, you know, because that's a really good thing to do, you know, when you're with a 9-year-old and it's night and you don't know where you're going to sleep that night and you're on a motorcycle, you know, cheer is really essential. So I'm, okay, this is great. This is going to be our campsite. So we park the bike, pull in, and it's just like a muddy slope into a stream, really small, and it's dark. And at this moment, my kid, who's been really holding it together like a champ all this time, bursts into tears. And I was about to burst into tears, but I decided this was probably not a good moment for me to burst into tears. And actually, I needed to like find it in me somehow right now to like find this, you know, parental wisdom of like everything's gonna be okay. So he starts sobbing hysterically, like can't breathe, sobbing hysterically, you know, totally freaking out, having a meltdown. And this is my moment. I have no idea what I'm going to say to him exactly. I have no idea what the plan is at this point, but I realize that I need to come up with one like immediately, and I need to do it and mean it. And so I just look at him, and I take him by the shoulders. No idea what I'm about to say. Listen, this isn't that bad. We're having an adventure. This is going to be a good story someday. Okay, so here's the plan. I have no idea what the plan is, okay? Here's the plan. Okay, we're going to turn this bike around, get back on this bike, we're going to roll down this hill, and make some new friends. So he's like, okay, Mom, okay, Mom, okay. Starting to catch his breath, like the dry heaving is slowing down. So the road that we're on, you know, it's dark, full dark now, not beautiful sunset dark. It's like the road that we're on is sloping down on both sides into like a watery trough, you know, and it's gravel. And I don't know if any of you like ride motorcycles. This is a 400 bike. It's an old 400 bike with, you know, not dirt tires. So I'm turning the bike around and feeling it starting to slide on the gravel. And, you know, once it starts sliding, I mean, it's a really heavy bike too. So I'm just like praying at this moment as I slowly turn it around, you know, that I can just make this turn, get the bike turned around, wipe the sweat off my brow, pretend like, you know, that was meant to happen, get back on the bike, he gets on behind me, and we start rolling slowly down the hill. I said, okay, my job is to like just keep us upright. Your job is to figure out where you want to camp tonight and who our new friends are going to be, okay? He's like, okay. So we start rolling down the hill. The very first campsite we stop at on the right. Well, I wasn't even about to stop there, but these two yelpy dogs come running out. He's like, slow down. I think this is it. So these two tiny little dogs are, you know, running out, barking at our tires, you know, trying to bite our tires. And then from behind them, you know, there comes like staggering this old man holding a beer. And I'm like, oh, great. You know, this looks like really scary. You know, this is like worst case scenario. And he comes up, oh, you know. What you guys doing out here? And I'm like, you know, and this is the moment. I'm like, this should be really sketchy. But, you know, Asher's hanging out with the dogs. Luckily, I have a leather jacket on and, you know, got a motorcycle, so they think I'm tough. And this other guy comes up behind him, and we're talking. And then, you know, after like 5 minutes of just conversation, you know, I look at Asher and we sort of explaining, oh, we were just, you know, I don't know, out for a ride, you know, camping. We don't really know where we're camping, though. And so they very quickly said, well, you know, you're more than welcome. We got a big site. You can totally come and stay with us. And, you know, in this flash moment, I'm like, you know, everything about this seems wrong, but I think this is actually safe. I think this is going to be okay. And I'm like, Asher, what do you think? Is this it? He's like, this is totally it. You know, he's already, like, in love with the dog, you know, so we go and sit down, and, you know, they have, like, extra chairs at their blazing campfire. We're sitting down. He offers me, I don't know, Steel Reserve or something. I'm like, okay, sure, you know, this is the moment. So I'm sitting there, and this kid is, like, totally, like, this 18-year-old, you know, and he's just wide-eyed and like, who are you? Where did you come from? And, you know, he sits down next to me, and he's like, you know, opening these foil packets with vegetables and I think chicken. And there's tons of food. And, you know, this kid is like, this is too weird. This is so weird that you're here. Like, this is my crazy uncle. I haven't seen him in, like, you know, I don't know, ever, since I was a baby. And you know, we were at the store today, and he was, like, buying tons of food. And, you know, I was like, we really don't need that much food. It's just the two of us. I'm leaving tomorrow. You know, we just have this one night together. And my uncle was like, well, you should always buy extra because you never know what might roll in. So that's kind of the end of the story, except for, I'll just tell you this one part because this is, like, hilarious. So this kid, you know, I set up my tent, got my kid to bed, and, you know, it was a totally peaceful night. And we were sitting at the fire for a little while longer. And he's from Roanoke. He's on the Appalachian Trail, walking the Appalachian Trail. So we were having a great time, you know, drinking Steel Reserve and staying up late. And, you know, the old man's snoring, my kid's sleeping. And he's just, like, still, like, really fascinated that I'm on this trip with my kid, you know, on a motorcycle, like, so far from home. And he asks me, so I've told him that I'm from Chicago. I was living in Chicago. I'm from Chicago. He's from outside of Roanoke. And he said, are you, and this is a totally serious question, he's like, are you, like, the weirdest person in your town? It's kind of a big town, you know. He's like, well, are you, like, the weirdest person on your block, then, he said. I was like, have you ever seen a block? Like, no, I don't even know anyone on my block. Which totally, like, he had no concept for at all. But anyway, he told me that he was definitely the weirdest kid in his school and in his town forever because he wore the same pair of red leather pants to school every day for a year.
All right, thanks. So, does anyone else have a story of something that happened in the blink of an eye? I see a hand back there. Come on up.
Hi, I'm Mike. Most of the people at my table have told a story, so I thought I'd come up and tell mine. My story is about being on the Greyhound and seeing... Really? I'm a low talker? Okay, it's a continuous thing through my life. I'm a low talker. Okay. Can everyone hear me? Okay, all right, thank you. Okay, how about this? Thank you, okay. So I was on the Greyhound and I saw the first happy ending in my life, like just something, like it was a story and it was a beautiful story and it was a love story and it ended happily. I was taking the Greyhound from Gainesville to Fort Lauderdale and I'm on the Gainesville and I'm on the Greyhound and it appears to me that my neighbor, the guy next to me, has just gotten out of jail and he's spent 3 years in jail and he's furiously flirting with the woman across from us. And it's kind of amazing. I'm just sort of like, oh my God, he just got out of jail and he's just right back on a horse, just flirting like crazy. And that woman's not really resisting. She's into the guy, she's like, hi, how are you? How is everything going? And it comes to this point where like he needs a pen, and he's asking me for a pen. And I'm an artist, and I'm opening my backpack, and I have like 20 pens, and I'm like searching through the pens. I'm like, oh no, that's a brush pen, that's too big. Oh, that's a Micron, that's too tiny. It's not gonna be helpful. And I'm pulling pen after pen out, going, I just need a regular pen for this guy to write down a number. This woman who's really interested in him. Okay, so that goes on, and the woman gets off the bus. They're both furiously staring at each other as they're leaving the bus. And, you know, the bus goes, we have a waypoint, and then he gets off. And then we get to talking at this waypoint, and I'm talking to the different people around, and it turns out there's a guy who he just got out of jail, and he's been there for 10 years. And he like shows us his pants and his boots, and it's like, oh, those are prison pants and boots, and you're just wearing a like little t-shirt thing. I'm like, oh, okay. And he starts talking about his wife, who he's not seen for 10 years, and I'm like, oh wow. And he's the nicest guy too. For 10 years in prison to get out that nice, I'm very impressed. I'm just like, wow, this is a nice guy. So we're on a 9-hour bus trip. And that's 9 hours and 10 years between him and his wife. And we're on this trip down, and everybody's slowly, like, he's the nicest guy on the bus. Like, everybody's just meeting him, and everybody knows his story. And then we pull into, like, Fort Lauderdale to the bus station, and there's his wife standing there. And like, she's just there. She's smiling. She's beautiful. Like, everyone's like, oh, there she is. Everybody's just excited as he's excited. And he's just sitting there. He's not running. He's not going crazy. And he slowly just gets up. Everyone, like, sort of, the people at the front get off the bus, and then he gets down, and he just hugs his wife. And it's one of the most beautiful things I ever saw. It's like the opposite of every tragic or, like, romance movie. Like, Romeo and Juliet, they die. Like, Titanic, they die. No, this is beautiful. They're, like, starting their life together after 10 years of being separated. And it was just very beautiful. I saw it out of the corners of my eyes. It was wonderful. And that's my story. Thank you.
Hi. I'm Justine, and I'm from SAW, and a lot of the storytellers tonight have all come from SAW, and we teach comics. So if you're interested in that, we're behind the co-op and the CMC, and I kind of hated for us to tell so many stories and not get a plug-in. I also have a show on Thursday mornings on Grow Radio at 11 o'clock, so tune in for that if you want to. Oh, I heard a woo, thank you. Anyway, see, I'm plugging like crazy, and nobody else is, so. My story is uncharacteristic. If you hear this story and you look at me, it's not going to make any sense. But I was in a club one night, and some goon, drunken goon, started to molest me. And I thought, if this ever happens to me again, I'm going to do something about it, because I just kind of brushed him away. I just didn't want to participate in this. But I was so angry with myself that I let this drunken asshole get away with this, that I promised that if it ever happened again, I would do something about it, because it was degrading, it was demeaning, and totally unnecessary. So I'm in another bar. Why I'm in all these bars, that's a good question. And hadn't I learned my lesson, that's the other good question. The reason I was in bars was I knew every musician in my hometown, and I would frequently go out to see them. So this was sort of a well-known blues bar. It's not really the right place for me, but there I was. And I was talking to somebody who suddenly got up in front of all of my friends, reached around behind me, and started grabbing my breasts and slobbering in my ear. And I was going to just brush him off. And then kind of I remembered how frustrated I was the last time this had happened to me, that I didn't do anything and I didn't make an example of this person. So in the blink of an eye, I worked that in, it occurred to me how to handle the situation, because unbeknownst to him, when I was younger, I had done a little bit of martial arts training that I had never used, didn't really understand, and was told to never use. But it all kind of came together in a split second, and I realized somehow that with him behind me and me sitting, I could grab him by the ear and then walk him across the bar so everybody could see the asshole. So I grabbed him by the ear, and I don't know how I worked this out, like in an instinct, but I knew exactly how to maintain my balance and how to keep him off balance. So I drug him around the bar by the ear, kind of like, look at my little pet asshole. And then I pinned him to the wall by the throat, which is, I don't know like what that was all about. And I just held him there. And then this is the really stupid part, and I have no idea why I said this, but looking back on it now, I feel vaguely like Barney Fife. But I had him pinned to the wall, and I said to him, I know three different ways to kill you. And that's not really the funny part. The funny part is, of course, I didn't know any ways to kill him. I vaguely knew one, but A, I didn't know if it would work, and B, I wasn't sure I was angry enough to try it. And then the next part is he actually looked at me and said, I know, I believe you. At that moment, I kind of was just all hyped up on adrenaline. The entire bar was, of course, silent, because this was actually the very last thing they expected to see. And there it was. And then I reeled back, and the rest of my training kicked in and said, well, you know, don't hit the poor bastard. He's already humiliated. The job's finished. So I just kind of thumped him with the palm of my hand, like, you know, you jackass, you idiot, what are you thinking? And then the owner of the bar came over, told me I was welcome back anytime, and told him he was never to come back again. So that's my blink of an eye story. Thank you.
Thanks. Great stories tonight, y'all. I was telling Jordan before I came up here that my stories are typically pointless and have no end, so I've just been floored by everyone.
I could probably stay, come up and say a lot of stories, so it's keeping it to 5 minutes. I'm going to try. So you might have to ask me in other times to fill in the blanks for some of this. My dad was from Denmark, and so I grew up going to Denmark, and I always wanted to go and live there. I didn't want to go to college. I didn't want to do anything. I just thought, I want to go and get away and live somewhere else. And so eventually I went and lived there for 3 years. And then I got really sick of it. I thought, I need to come back to the States and figure out how to do that. But I didn't know what to do. I ended up living in New Mexico. I ended up living in Santa Fe because I had this vague notion that I needed to go to St. John's College, who does the Great Books program. Some of you maybe know this. It's like you start over and read the whole Western, the whole canon of Western civilization as your education. And I thought this was a really good idea for some reason. And so I actually lived there and I applied. And the day came where I was going to be told whether I was going to get in and get out or not be accepted. And this wonderful admissions counselor gave me the bad news that it was a split decision and I could just reapply some other time. And I was amazed at how wonderfully freeing this was. It's like, I don't have to go to this school. I can do anything I want. I don't have to stay here for 4 years. Oh my God, this is beautiful. And she's just really kind of freaked out. She just like, you're happy. It's like, this is the best day of my life. Thank you so much. Oh, and it's like, what the hell am I going to do with myself? I can do anything. And I said, I'm going back to Europe and I'm just going to go and travel. I can do this. And luckily, because my dad, I had a Danish passport. So it's like, you know, and if anything interesting comes along the way, I could stop and work. You know, it's a part of the EU. And so I went back to Europe. And I visited friends, I went to Denmark, I went to England, I went to the Netherlands, I went to France. And I'm just like, what am I gonna do? 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 And I'm just enjoying myself having all these really wonderful adventures. And I end up in Rome. Has anybody been to Italy in August? It sucks. It's hot, it's muggy, and it's full of tourists. It's gross. And all, you know, I had met someone who said, oh, when you go to Rome, stay at the Pension Paradiso on Plaza de Paradiso in Rome. It's like, it's really cheap. It's where all the hookers hang out. You can hang out with them. And it's like, oh, that sounds like so much fun. That'll be a Roman adventure. And so I get to the train station in Rome. I get my directions and I go there. And it's been gentrified. It is now a middle-class tourist hotel. The piazza is all clean, and there's little tables and, like, selling all this kind of tourist crap. And I go, shit. What am I going to do? I don't want to be here. What? I'm in Rome. This is my first chance in Rome. So I just start wandering around and looking at all this ancient civilization, and I'm actually grossed out because it's all geared for tourists. And it's just like, ugh, maybe if I came back in March or something, maybe if I came back, whatever. And I'm just like really sick. And I was just like really just like wandering the streets and just not knowing what to do. Oh, there's the Colosseum. Oh, there's this. Oh, where's the good pizza here? Because I'm trying pizza and it's like crappy. And it's like, shit, what am I going to do? And I'm just wandering around in a daze. And then I come upon this little tiny piazza. And there's a fountain in the middle of it. And there are these beautiful little frogs that are spitting water into the fountain. And this happens to be the frog fountain that I had seen in a friend's Rome art book when I lived in Denmark that I fell in love with. And I was like, oh,
this is why I've come to Rome. This is what I've come to see. I've seen what I've wanted to see. Now what I'm going to do. And out from the heavens came this voice. Move to Chicago. And I'm... And it's like, what? Move to Chicago. And what do you do when this voice comes out of the heavens and tells you to do this after you've accomplished what you need to do in Rome? You move to Chicago. I somehow got from Rome to Copenhagen in less than 24 hours through a little twist of magic in Hamburg where I had to change trains. The schedule said that you couldn't do it, but trains somehow got there 2 minutes early, and somehow I dashed the whole length of the terminal at Hamburg to get to the other one, and I run, get on the train, and then I look back, and there are about 30 other people behind me doing the exact same thing. And so it's like, oh, this is planned, this piece of magic, because they know that this is how you get these connections. And I get back to Copenhagen, say goodbye to my friends, and fly to Chicago, where my whole new life unfolds. And, you know, this is where I meet my friend Mary. This is where I become an activist. This is where I become an art organizer. This is when everything happens because I listened to this voice that came from the heavens. So when you hear those voices from the heavens, take them seriously because they're probably telling you something you really have to do. Thank you.
Thanks. I wasn't timing, but great.
All right, so everyone else at my table, I think, except one person, has told a story. So I think I'm obligated to come up and finish telling stories for the saw table, the bad kids in the back corner. So my name is Sally. And this is kind of... I guess it fits into the category of pointless stories that don't go anywhere. But I don't know, how many of you guys have been to a concert and have been in like, or like a local show where you've been in like a mosh pit or on the barricade at a really small show? Yeah, so you know, it's completely insane. You can't breathe, you're sweating on everyone, everyone's sweating on you. There's crowd surfers going over your head. But this story takes place at a show, and I was there with my best friend, and her name is Mel, and she is 5 foot nothing, and she will not go in the pit unless she can get onto the barricade, like right front row, so she has something to hold on to so she doesn't get trampled. And we had somehow, by whatever twist of magic and waiting out too early for the show, made it to barricade, and we were there for one of our favorite bands, and we were very excited. We were on the barricade, and maybe like halfway through the set, we were starting to get tired, we were starting to get dehydrated, it was starting to get crazy. The band was playing a song that was a little older, so all of the old fans and all the people who had been drinking for 5 hours during the opening bands was, you know, they were all like, yeah, we're so excited, we're gonna crowd surf, we're gonna mosh, it's great. And we're just trying to hold on for dear life. And at that point, I was holding on to, she was on the barricade, and I was kind of protecting her. You know, I was holding on to the barricade on either side of her, you know, trying to keep her from getting pushed back or pushed too far forward and getting crushed. And we had this moment where we locked eyes with the singer and everything just kind of stopped. And you have to remember at the end of the story, it ends up taking place in a period of less than 2 minutes. So we lock eyes with the singer and like everything stops. Like we're like, wow. And then all of a sudden it just goes black. It just boom. A crowd surfer had landed on my shoulders, like his butt had landed like right on the back of my neck, like he had landed on my head. So his feet had gone right onto Mel. And she went down because she is 5 foot nothing, and she was just, and there was just, it happened so fast. All of a sudden, she went down. I got scared. I was pushing everyone out of the way. I was just like, move, I gotta get my friend. And security was trying to pull her out. And I just completely abandoned my place, and I just ran out of the pit. I was just knocking people out of the way. I was just running to where security was, and I was like, oh my God, did you see a little redhead girl get pulled out? Did you see her? They're like, this kid was just like, what? You mean like the one that was having a seizure? I was like, oh my God, Mel's having a seizure, oh my God. And I get to the security guard, you know, they had taken her along the barricade, like almost to like the backstage area, but slightly off the side. I was like, oh my God, this tiny little redhead girl, oh my God, did you see where she went? Is she back there? Is she okay? Is she, can I go see her? Oh my God. He's like, calm down, breathe. She's back there, she's fine. And I went back there, and she's sitting in a chair, you know, security, like the EMTs had given her water. She's like, dude, I'm fine. I was crying, I was hysterical. I was like, oh my God, Mel, I'm so sorry this happened to you. Oh my God. Like, now we're gonna miss the whole concert. She's like, no, we're not, it's fine. I'm okay, you're fine. And, you know, by the time she had, by the time she had finished drinking her water and we had come back outside, the song wasn't even over yet. We were just, it had happened so fast, and it didn't even register to me, like, how quickly it had happened. And, you know, at the end of the night, I got yelled at by the security guy. He's like, man, he's like, you guys, you gotta learn how to hold your ground. You gotta learn how to take care of each other. You gotta stand tough. And I'm like, you're yelling at a 5 foot tall girl, like telling her to like stand her ground. And I think the funniest part of it was like, he turned to my friend Mel, he's like, your girlfriend was so freaked out. And I was like, oh no, even the security thinks we're dating. But anyway, that's my story.
I've kind of been surprised at how many stories haven't been about accidents, because that's the first thing that came to my mind when in the blink of an eye, because it seems like accidents always happen that quickly. But that is the theme this week, in the blink of an eye, for the conch. Storytelling, true stories, less than 5 minutes. Has anyone else got a story about something that happened? Huh? Only 10 minutes left. Two more stories. Two more. All right. Here's the second to last.
Hi, I'm Sean. I had the rare, well, not rare privilege, but privilege of working at the Sovereign Restaurant in town for a little while. If anyone knows what that is, it was a restaurant that's now the Oyster House. And it was huge. It could house, you know, 200 some odd people. There was an actual chef there that did everything from scratch in a way that no one really does anymore. Anyway, he was a very interesting character named Elmo, Chef Elmo. A couple stories just to set up his bravado, I guess. I once helped him, you know, there was a big gate, sort of castle style gate that was outside, and it said, no, deliveries between, you know, this hour and this hour. And this, you know, delivery guy sort of was like, well, screw this, I'm here now, I'm gonna come in the front door and deliver all this beer. And Elmo was very strict and by the book. And so when this guy brought the beer and he said, you need to take that out of here. And he said, no, I'm not going to. And he left the beer there. And he kind of waved us all in, and we all grabbed a case of beer and then just proceeded to follow the guy out to the street and he had us throw the cases of beer at the truck. I also watched him on several occasions like wield a meat cleaver out to tables on busy nights that were being unusually or unnecessarily particular about their meals and just sort of stand at the table and talk to them politely with this large knife and then just invite them to never come back again. On another occasion, I watched him punch out a waiter that talked back to him in the wait station. And then the waiter continued working because he was so afraid of what might happen to him if he didn't keep working. But on one particular night, this was a football night when we would do, you know, 400 covers or something like that. And I, as a prep cook, had sort of dropped the ball in a huge way and didn't grate a bunch of Parmesan cheese, which takes quite a long time. It's an involved process because you would get actual wheels of Parmesan cheese and have to cut them. And it's not something you want to do in a rush. Anyway, he found out that that had happened, that I had failed him miserably, and he was very angry about that. So I ran to the back to try and do this very quickly, and in the process got Parmesan rind, which is a very thick thing to deal with, stuck in a Hobart meat grinder, which is like a, it's basically like a record size, you can attach a cheese grater to it, which is basically like a record sized cheese grater. And you feed it in, you feed things into a hole about the size of an arm conveniently. And anyway, so the correct way to do this is to cut the cheese into very small pieces. The way you do this when it's a Tennessee game weekend is you cut it into very large pieces and try and force it through this machine. So anyway, the cheese got stuck in the machine, appearing that the machine would, you know, be off. Anyway, cheese got stuck, machine stopped. I ran to go get something to help myself get the cheese out of there, forgetting that I left the machine on. And in the process of getting the cheese out, the machine grabbed my finger and part of my hand and just sort of took it. I managed to get it out. I got it out. It grated my hand, you know, where there were actual lines in my hand, not just like ripped skin off. It actually ripped the lines through my fingernails. And I kind of just looked at it, and then my first thought was, God, Elmo's going to kill me. He's gonna kill me. And so, you know, I go to him, and he had a couple sayings that he would always revert to when he was angry. And they all came out in this instant. And I just sort of was standing at the end of the line, holding my hand in shock. And I'm looking at him, and there's, you know, people firing back and forth between the grill and the flat top and the fryer. And I said, hey, Elmo, I cut my finger. He's like, why are you bothering me with this crap? I said, I cut my finger pretty bad. I put it in the Hobart. What are you doing putting your finger in the Hobart? I said, I didn't mean to. It just, you know, it takes it. It just takes it. It was a, why was it on when you were putting your finger in it? Anyway, I have to talk to you back here about my hand. And I finally convinced him to, like, come back and see. And he gets getting the first aid kit out, which consists of, like, Band-Aids and Neosporin and, again, like, you know, staples. And he's just like, you know, let me see it. And I pull my hand out, and he just sort of screams, and he goes, what happens? I blink my eye, and you burn your, you kill your hand? And at that point, he said something else like, you're always full of this Mickey Mouse crap. anyway, his lovely wife, who was also very angry with me at the time, because she's the hostess of the restaurant, had to drive me to the hospital, where I sat for several hours, but eventually got my hands stitched up and went back to work, no big deal. That's kind of my story, but also in a related note to that man and in honor of him, he passed away a few years ago, and in a blink of an eye, he passed away. He was a motorcycle aficionado, and some woman pulled out in front of him in a camper, and he just ran into her. But he was a great man, great Gainesville guy, great Gainesville story, I guess. That's it. Thanks.
All right, we've got time for one more. Who wants to wrap up the night? Ah! Your bartender for the evening wants to do one. Jordan.
All right. So I got to tell a fun football story last time, and I was trying to think of, my name's Jordan, by the way, sorry, thanks. So this time I thought I would tell a fight story. It's one of the two fights I've ever got into in my life, and it happened, the first one was very planned. It was one of these, like, there was a little tussle at the bus stop in middle school, and I was like, I'm going to meet you behind the Circle K, and we're going to fight. And that was, you know, that was a different story. Maybe I'll find a reason to tell it. But this one, we got jumped, and it happened really fast. And I was with five of my friends, and we're like middle school age, so I don't know where that is, like 14 or 13 or somewhere in there. You know, we're young, but like I was in Kung Fu and I was tough. I was a ninja. I was learning nunchucks and I was good. I could flip them around. They were foam, but I could flip them around and bounce them off my head and my butt and whatever. And it was, you know, it looked fast. And doing the reverse figure eight was really hard. And I got that down. So I was on top of the game. And but I didn't even know I needed to be a ninja this day. It was my friend's birthday. And there's five of us. Like, we were neighborhood friends. We were these kids. We all grew up in the same neighborhood. Like, I knew some of them since I was 4 years old. And now we're 13, and, like, I'm starting to grow a mustache a little bit and a little bit of a beard. I was really proud of my little beard. And it's my buddy's birthday, and this, so there's five of us all together, and we're walking down the street. And we own this neighborhood. Like, this has been our neighborhood forever. And it's the main street. We've just been allowed, maybe a few years back, to walk along this street because it's a busy road. And now that we're, you know, we're older kids, we're in middle school now, our parents have said, all right, you can walk down the busy road. Well, we're walking down the busy road, and we're talking, and I don't know what about, Magic the Gathering cards or superheroes or whatever it is we like. This car drives by, and occasionally on the busy road, there'll be high school kids who'll yell things at you. You know, very occasionally, but sometimes, you know, something will get thrown at you just because there's some punk kids, you know, driving around in their cars having fun. So these people didn't yell at us, but they pulled in the block right ahead of us. And they did it kind of fast, and we were like, oh, somebody just pulled ahead. But we didn't think anything of it. It was a bit of the way. We were at the, you know, the beginning of one block, and they were at the beginning of the other that they pulled into. So we're just walking, and then I see these three high school kids walking towards us. And they're bigger than we are, but there's only three of them. And I'm still not, like, my mind is not thinking of odds and angles and fights yet. Not yet. But they start walking towards us, and we're just, you know, we're giggling. They're not even really on any of our radar, and all of a sudden they're right in front of us. And the one kid, he's shorter than me, but he's big. He works out. He's a tough guy, whatever. He's probably on the football team. And he's all like, you gonna give up the sidewalk? And I laughed. I was like, what? Like this, you know, this is my neighborhood. You know, I live here. You know, this is like, I ride my bike around here. I skateboard. Like, I almost set that office building on fire one time. Like, this is our place. And you gonna give up the sidewalk? And I just went like that. And in the moment I closed my eyes, his fist hit me right in the face, like, boom. And I immediately was like, I'm a ninja. And I just, like, everything just happened at once. And I punched him in the face, and I punched him again in the face, and then I kicked the other guy. And I kicked the other guy, like a really good ninja kick, you know, right in the chest. He fell back, and he was like, whoa, this guy's all over the place. And then I went, why am I fighting two guys at once? There's five of us here. And I turn around, and I look, and one of my friends is going that way, one is going that way, one is running across the street, like, through traffic. And in the blink of an eye, now I'm running. And I am running for my life. Like, I have never run this fast. And I'm a very bad runner. Like, I'm just not very good at running. And I started to get, I don't know if you've ever had to run really fast for your life, but sometimes you start to get a little ahead of your body, gets a little ahead of your feet, and you start to get overbalanced, and you start to, like, oh no. And I was starting to feel that moment where I knew I was gonna fall, and I knew these kids were gonna catch me. And of course, I was the last one, and I hit them, so they were after me. And just as I was about to fall, another car pulls in front of the block ahead of me. And I'm like, oh no. Like, they have friends in the car, like, something's going on. And again, like a blink of an eye, here's this guy. He's a different friend entirely. Different kid's father comes out of this car with a 9-iron, and he's swinging it like a gorilla. You know, he's just like, whoa, you know. I was saved. Like, the kids immediately turned around, and they ran wherever they were going. And, like, I don't know. There it was. Three blinks, and what a fun time. Anyway. Thank you.
All right. Thank everyone for your stories tonight. We no dead moments here. This is the Conk. We'll be here the second Tuesday of every month. And we don't have a topic yet for next month, but stay tuned to the Facebook page, and I'm sure it'll be posted there. So thanks again to Satchels, LSE, and everyone who told the story. It was a great night.
Hey, can we hear it for Natalie? This is her first time hosting the Conk. Just wanted to add, you can hear the broadcast of this evening's stories on growradio.org. And it'll be on the fourth Saturday of the month. So I don't know the date of that yet. I apologize, but fourth Saturday in a couple weeks. You can check it out online. Thanks for all the great stories.